Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how Arizona's research institutions are preparing for potential cuts from the Trump administration, and a Flagstaff astronomer on why he gets excited about tiny asteroids. But first, the legal tide may be turning for Arizona's so-called fake electors. They cleared a significant hurdle this week in their attempt to get the case filed against them by Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays thrown out of court. And they did it by using what's known as Arizona's anti-SLAPP law, which is designed to prevent politically motivated prosecutions. Until 2022, that law only applied to civil cases, but Republican lawmakers expanded it to cover criminal charges as well. And now the judge is allowing the defendants, all Republicans, to move forward and try to prove their case. That also gives the Attorney General's office a chance to argue that the charges are justified. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk has been covering it all and sitting in court for many hours, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hi there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so this all centers around politics, right? Like, and if Chris Mays' prosecution of these fake electors was politically motivated, what has she said that they're trying to use to prove that argument now?
Yeah, it's kind of a two-bar thing. They have to prove that it's politically motivated and also that it's being used to stifle those First Amendment rights. So They're pointing to statements made on the campaign trail by her, statements made by some of her top lieutenants on social media about the case, and that essentially this was something that she wanted to stop ahead of time. This case is designed to make sure this doesn't happen again. And they're saying that shows that, you know, that this is a political motive, not necessarily a desire to enforce the law.
Right. And this was obviously a political kind of issue to begin with the fake electors in general. Remind us what Mays is accusing them of. This was all part of the fallout from the 2020 election, when there were a lot of folks kind of denying that Biden had won Arizona.
Yeah, this focuses on the 11 Republicans in Arizona who signed a document, sent it to Congress and other federal and state officials that said, "We are the duly elected electors from Arizona, casting our votes for President Trump. The only problem is former President Biden won Arizona in 2020. So they're saying that that is essentially a forged document intended to commit a fraud against Arizona voters who elected Biden. And those are the crimes that they're alleging: forgery, fraud, conspiracy to commit those crimes.
Okay. So they're making several arguments, but let's focus for a moment on this anti-SLAPP law argument. What are the defendants saying? How are they kind of testing out this newly expanded anti-SLAPP law?
So as you mentioned, yeah, it's newly expanded to cover criminal cases in 2022. What they're saying is basically that what we did, number one, is protected speech. This is our right to petition our government for redress, which essentially means we think the government messed up and we want them to fix it. And then that, along with free speech, and that what Mays is doing, what the prosecutors are doing here, is essentially stepping in and saying, trying to put us in jail for expressing those rights.
Okay. Why did the judge say he's letting this argument go forward in court?
So the first step in these cases, as outlined in the law, is they have to provide something called prima facie proof. And for the lawyers for those in the audience who are not lawyers, it basically means on its face. So it's a lower barrier than like proving a case or to get the full dismissal. The judge essentially said that they provided enough evidence that that may have been the case, that, you know, Mays may have made some politically charged statements, and that the actions they took may encompass some First Amendment protected rights. He's not saying that that's definitely what happened. He's just saying they provided enough proof to make a good faith argument that that could have occurred.
Okay. So this is one of the first times, as you mentioned, that this anti-SLAPP law has been used like this. What kind of precedent could it set?
Again, like, until it gets to like the state Supreme Court, it won't be any sort of binding precedent. But it's the first time we're seeing what prima facie proof means in a case like this. So you could definitely see other judges looking to this decision in absence of a Supreme Court decision to say, you know, what standard was this judge using? And so it kind of gives us a glimpse into what a case like this could look like in the future, and what type of evidence defendants would need to present to the court in order to make this type of argument.
Yeah. Okay, so both sides will get a chance to make their case in front of the judge in the coming months. But defendants have also been busy in court this week arguing a whole lot of other things about why this case should not continue. What else are they arguing?
So they filed like half a dozen other motions to dismiss this case, which isn't rare in very complex cases like this. They're mm-hmm. coming at it from a variety of legal theories. A lot of those arguments really centered on the idea that they don't believe the state, i.e. Attorney General Mays, even had the authority to bring these charges in the first place. They point to the Electoral Count Act, which is a federal law dating back like over 100 years that kind of shows how the Congress has to count electoral votes in a presidential election. And they're saying that law contemplated multiple slates of electors coming in because there's some phrasing in there about the vice president and the Senate and everyone looking at different documents and that and opening them all at the very least, if not acknowledging them. Mm. Long story short, they're saying Congress, not the state, is the one that has the authority to decide which electors are the right ones, which are the fake ones, not the state bringing these forgery charges to try and adjudicate that.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. When will the judge rule on those arguments?
We don't know. All he said is he will rule on them. But like I said, lots of arguments made. He's got a lot of documents to read through. He's got to go back and consider all the arguments made in court over the past few days. So we know he'll make them, but it'll likely be weeks, months before we hear anything back on that.
Okay. So we've never seen a case like this, not really ever seen this particular anti-SLAPP law tried in this way, right? Do you think it's likely they'll be able to get this case dismissed in the end?
I really can't say. I mean, the judge was very clear to say that his decision earlier this week letting the anti-SLAPP motion move forward in no way meant that he was dismissing the case.
Mm-hmm.
He was just saying that they met this initial burden of proof. Now, he said it's a two-part, it's kind of a two-part system here. Now, this, as you mentioned, the state gets to come back and file their documents saying why the charges should stick, proving that they're not politically motivated. And that is really going to be the tell is kind of what the state's arguments are and how the judge decides in this, like you said, will set some precedent that will be interesting and affect cases like this in the future.
Yeah. So Mays obviously said they disagree with that decision to let this motion go forward. But are the fake electors here feeling pretty confident or what are they saying about this?
They've been pretty mum since that came out. But you can imagine they're obviously very happy because the alternative to the judge making that decision is just saying, no, you didn't meet the burden of proof. And then the anti-SLAPP argument is gone.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, as you mentioned, Attorney General Mays indicated she will be appealing even this ruling. So not even waiting for the judge to rule on the anti-SLAPP motion, but she'll be appealing his decision that they met that burden of proof. So we haven't seen that appeal yet, but we're expecting it.
Lots to watch for. Okay. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always.
Thank you.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked a move by the Trump administration to cut federal research funding in those states that joined a lawsuit challenging the move. Arizona is among them. The National Institutes of Health issued a memo last week saying it would cap grants for what's known as indirect costs at 15%. That would be nearly a halving of that funding. Indirect costs pay for things like staffing, facilities, and administration. More arguments in the case are expected later this month. It is into this environment that Dr. Corey Casper begins his new role as chief research officer at Banner Health. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, who asked what interested Casper about this job.
Yeah, so, you know, I've worked for more than 25 years on biomedical research in a number of different research environments. What I think is particularly compelling about working for Banner Health is it sort of flips the traditional model of biomedical research that we use in this country. So at many academic centers, you have a very large enterprise that's trying to both deliver healthcare, but also trying to conduct biomedical research. And I think it's very hard to do both well. Many academic medical centers across the country right now are losing a tremendous amount of money and struggling to provide top quality care, only because both of those things, you know, sitting side by side are so challenging. What's really unique about Banner Health is it's really widely regarded as, you know, a model of nonprofit healthcare delivery. And they really have that down pat.
So what kinds of research are you most interested in pursuing here at Banner?
Yeah, so obviously for many, many years, Banner, I would say, has the preeminent program anywhere in the world in its research for Alzheimer's disease. So we really need to continue that work and make sure that Banner continues to be at the forefront of both the early detection and prevention of Alzheimer's disease. I think that's critical. At the same time, I think that based on the patient population that Banner deals with in its six different states, I think we have a real opportunity to broaden the research portfolio of Banner along with our academic partners at the University of Arizona and the MD Anderson Cancer Center. And to that, what I'm really interested in looking at is the intersection between acute infectious diseases and chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, cancer, and neurologic diseases. And I think that what we're finding right now is that the past 20 years of progress in cancer research, coupled with the past 5 to 10 years of research in infectious diseases that have been accelerated by the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, those two things have intersected in a way to give us incredibly unique tools to interrogate and to modulate the human immune system to prevent and to treat disease. And that's where I'd like to see our focus over the next several years.
I'm wondering how all of that might be impacted by what we've been hearing about coming from DC in terms of NIH grants and other federal funding potentially getting reduced or removed altogether. What kind of impact might that have on the research you're doing at Banner?
Yeah, so all of the recent discussions around changes in federal funding for research and changes in the priority of the federal research agenda clearly have an enormous potential impact on this country's biomedical research and complex. That being said, I think that most of us who have been doing this for a while are trying to take a long view. I think that improving the health of patients in this country through biomedical research, and again, there's proven gains. I mean, we've dropped the death rate due to cancer dramatically due to biomedical research in the past 20 years. We've dropped the death rate due to cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, significantly over the last 20 years. And all of that is attributable to research. So when we take the long view that I think, regardless of what your political beliefs are, you probably are in favor of better health outcomes for all of us. I have to believe that while there'll be changes in prioritization and changes in mechanism, in the long view, I'd have to believe that this will continue to be a strong country for the conduct of impactful biomedical research.
In the short term, though, I mean, are there potentially studies going on or research going on that could be impacted or could be delayed maybe beyond repair if funding doesn't come through?
Absolutely. So, I mean, taking a step back, I think it's important to think a little bit about how the federal government funds research. So first and foremost, I mean, I think that while in a perfect world, there might be a direct relationship between the amount of federal funding and the burden of a disease, that's probably not the case. I mean, one of the most common diseases that we see in our population is diabetes. It certainly is not the greatest source of funding from our federal government. So, the reality is there's always been a disconnect between how common a disease is and how much funding goes towards it. If that's not the beacon by which we figure out the prioritization of our funding for medical research, that means that other things influence that. And politics is certainly one of them. So, in this particular political climate, I think what we have heard is that there are some people in government right now who believe that there's an overprioritization on vaccines, infectious diseases, research involving, vulnerable populations. And I think that, to the extent that the current administration can change that prioritization, I think they will. And so I think that that's something that in the short term will clearly affect how biomedical research is conducted in the United States. It's hard for me to tell whether that's irreparable or whether that those changes are permanent. But what I would say is that for right now, it will have to change the way that work is funded. Maybe it will be picked up for funding by philanthropy or by the private sector. But for right now, I think there's no doubt that that there will be a change in the type of research that is being conducted.
Yeah, I was going to ask if not, the federal government and not NIH, are there other places where funding could be acquired to do some of this research? Sounds like maybe is the answer.
Yeah. So again, another reason that I think that I was so excited to come to Banner is Banner, much like your own financial portfolio, I hope is very blended and mixed. So, you don't want to put 100% of your investments in one particular financial vehicle. Mm-hmm. Much like that, I think a healthy approach to the funding of biomedical research is to have a diversified portfolio. So at Banner, we take that very seriously. Federal funding, is hard fought and won. It's what's called peer reviewed. So you know that that work that's being done is at a very high level. And, it's very special to get that federal funding. At the same time, we've worked very closely with the private sector. So working with the pharmaceutical industry to assure that we have access to the latest drugs that are being developed for conditions that our patients are suffering from, and that they have access to that they wouldn't have access to in the course of regular medical care. That's very important. And philanthropic funding has been incredibly important for, let's say, our Alzheimer's research. And we can do things that are catalytic and are high risk, high reward that you couldn't do with other types of funding.
Is it safe to assume that that helps inform the kind of research that you do or that you're able to do, depending on where the funding is coming from?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what I would say is that, yes. So the nice thing about federal funds is that generally an investigator comes up with an idea. They write a proposal to study that idea. They submit it to the federal government. It gets rigorously reviewed, and then it gets funded. When you're looking at philanthropic or private commercial funding, it typically is something that is within the funder's priorities and within the funder's interests. So I would say that both industry-supported and philanthropic research come with more of an agenda than the pure sort of academic exercise of putting in a federal grant.
All right. That is Dr. Corey Casper, the Chief Research Officer for Banner Health. Corey, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the study of our solar system isn't just about planets.
Astronomers studying the solar system, they think about Jupiter, they think about Pluto, they think about stuff that is pretty big in the grand scheme of things, right? But the vast majority of objects in the solar system are what we call the small bodies, the comets, the asteroids.
We'll hear from an astronomer who studies these small bodies. But first, Phoenix New Times has a new editor-in-chief. Sam Eifling comes to the paper after spending many years as a writer. He started out as a New Times reporter in Broward County, Florida, and went on to write features for places like Mother Jones, Sports Illustrated, and Grantland. He's also written for television, and last year he was part of the team that released a serialized podcast about the rise and fall of the New Times empire, part of which he's now tasked with leading. It's a complex task, and Eifling recently stopped by the studio to talk with it about it with the show's Sam Dingman.
I read this old piece of yours that you did for the Broward Palm Beach New Times in 2006 about this guy who died in a traffic accident, Jason Lewis. Was it Livers or Livers?
I think Livers, yeah. Oh, gosh, that is going way back. So it's almost 20 years.
Yeah.
It was just a news item that I found in the Sun Sentinel. As an alt-weekly reporter, you're looking through whatever sources you can, whatever news sources you can grab a hold of to see what are the stories that exist in the community and what are the ones that maybe haven't been fully told. And the item was so small. It was basically that this guy in his mid-20s had gotten out of a car on one of the busiest, craziest, high-flyingest overpasses in the interstate system there, and had been struck multiple times and died.
Yeah.
I was like, why is anybody up there? What's going on? And it was actually one of my favorite stories to report because I only had that nugget. And I was able to peel it back and really figure out, okay, here was a kid who's from a small town in Kentucky. He had come to South Florida and had really gotten caught up in the parties.
Yeah.
The abundant openly gay men, which he didn't have in small-town Kentucky, right?
Right. You write about this in the piece, that this was a place where he could just be himself.
Exactly, right? He could let it all out. And he was a person who, and I think we all get to this point at some point in our lives where we're offered something that we think we really want, and it turns out there's too much of it. And he was a guy, he was going too hard. He was drinking too much, and he was doing drugs, and he was, it's funny you bring that piece up. It's kind of a random piece, but it's one that I think back on because I really did love the reporting process in that, which was to say there's more behind this tiny item.
Totally. Absolutely. Well, I mean, for me, that's what I loved about reading it was this sense of I've been to Broward a couple of times, and my main association with it is like strip malls and like Jamba Juices, you know? And here I read this story, which, as you said, was just like lifted from this little passing news item. And it ends up not just introducing me to this person, but it tells me something about this place that I might take for granted as something not that interesting is a haven for this person. And all of a sudden, I have this deeper understanding of it in the space of learning about this one guy. And it struck me as so illustrative of the type of reporting that was possible during that early 2000s time at alt weeklies like the New Times. And now you're here to lead the Phoenix New Times. Do you feel like there's an opportunity to bring that kind of reporting back to life? Or
yes and no. It's a complex question. I think for us, the challenge right now, because so many people's media consumption is automated on TikTok and on Instagram. You look at the number of hours people spend on Instagram. It's bonkers.
It's insane.
It's crazy times, right? We just need a little bit of that attention on the paper. Once upon a time, you went to the bar, you didn't have a phone in your pocket, your phone didn't have every contact of everybody you've ever met.
Right.
It didn't have shiny apps trying to grab your attention. It didn't have Tinder, Grindr, whatever you've got where people are literally hitting on you through your pocket while you're sitting there. It used to be you had to show up and start a conversation with random people at the bar, and a really good way to either kill time or start those conversations was to pick up the Alt Weekly, which was heavy back then.
It was free, and it was probably 200 pages. It was right
free.
Outside the bar,
right? It was going to tell you what's going on. Here's something grabby. Here's something sexy. Here's something funny. Here's something weird. Here's something, right?
And
a really good weekly, it would hit all these notes.
Yeah.
And what you get out of it is totally up to you, right? It's
totally.
Not Mark Zuckerberg tweaking knobs to decide what you read. It's people trying to figure out what is going to be interesting and relevant to you.
Right. Well, but the Instagram connection is actually really fascinating, I think, because Instagram now is so much of what an alt weekly used to be. Now you go to the bar, you sit down. If you're there by yourself, you just scroll through Instagram a little bit because you don't want to be sitting at the bar doing nothing. That's embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you go to Instagram for? You go to see pictures from people's private lives that you arguably, you know, maybe shouldn't see. You go there to find about what's cool music. You go there to find like the real story about what's happening in the news that like the mainstream media isn't telling you.
Totally.
Supposedly. All of which is the kind of thing we used to get from an alt weekly.
Yeah, I think Henry David Thoreau would call it gossip. It all falls under gossip. Reporting is about the reader. Journalism is about the reader. It's about the audience. And people who are reading aren't there. Put us there. Make this cinematic.
Yeah, right.
Like the reader wants to start forming a movie in their head. Like tell it like a dream. You're trying to hypnotize them for a minute so that they don't run away and scroll through something else.
Right.
Or don't,
yeah.
Right? Like put me there.
More of a subjective, singular perspective on a place.
I think that's what we want as readers going to a writer. What people want to know. It's like, okay, but what did you really think about that?
Right.
And so we should tell them.
Well, you're making me think, and tell me if you disagree, that what you're describing is a meaningful counter to what you get from a TikTok video or an Instagram reel or something, because it's somebody where the camera's too close to their face, they have food in their mouth, the sound isn't very good, the image is very, very jagged, and they're like openly crying about whatever they're talking about, and there's text going by on the screen, there's music playing, it's overwhelming. But I think what resonates with people about that is that it's authentic.
Well, let us not overlook the incredible power of a really good, well-crafted, well-reported story. Then it's just ink on dead trees, and suddenly you're inhabiting someone else's life. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, this is awesome stuff.
Well, so if I may, Sam, and again, tell me if I'm hearing this wrong. You know, coming into this conversation, I thought to myself, you know, you're a young guy. You've worked in all forms of quote-unquote new media, whatever that means. And you're coming to this legacy paper that has obviously gone through a lot of iterations over the decades that it has existed, but it's still here. And I could imagine longtime fans of a paper like that thinking, okay, this new guy's here. Is he going to take it away from the tree pulp and text roots that it had? And I feel like what I'm hearing you saying is that you want to double down on writing. You want to invest more deeply in that?
Well, we're, in some ways, we're the keepers of this flame. And what I don't want to be is a caretaker of a, of something that's in decline, right? Right? I really would like us to see that relationship to me of reader and publication is one of like co-conspirator. Like we should be helping you figure out your best life, helping you understand the community you live in, and also being something that you look forward to because it's kind of, it's a little off to the side and it's for you. I have tried to do that probably everywhere I've worked. I am an easy person to fire. I've worked at places where I do not think the bosses really liked what I was doing because I didn't really care about them as much as I cared about putting my name on work that was really good. And man, I think reporting is where it's at. They have to pay editors more because the job is not as fun,
right?
Honestly.
All right. Well, Sam Eifling is the newly minted editor-in-chief of Phoenix New Times. Sam, thank you for this conversation. Good luck.
Oh, such a joy. Thank you.
And this is the show.
And this is 91.5 and KJZZ.org on this Wednesday morning. Here and Now starts at 10, and of course at 12:30, it's Today Explained. You can always find out about all of our programs on our website, KJZZ.org. Partly cloudy today in Phoenix, a high of just 65 degrees. The clouds are going to hang around for the next several days. About a 20% chance we might see some rain tomorrow, but temperatures rising to the low 70s, pretty close to average through the weekend ahead. It is 55 degrees right now in Phoenix at 9:36.
KJZZ is supported by Scan Health Plan, a not-for-profit Medicare Advantage plan that has been dedicated to the health and independence of members since 1977. More information at scanhealthplan.com.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Across the ocean, overlooking an idyllic lake away from the lights of Rome, the Vatican, the seat of the Catholic Church, runs an observatory to study the cosmos. And this might very well lead to an obvious question. What is the Vatican doing with an observatory?
It's a very odd thing, Vatican having observatory. Indeed, why isn't it doing things in church as one expects?
That's Father Chris Corbelli, who told me the Vatican isn't just the seat of the Pope, it's a state, Vatican City. So, like many countries, including ours, it has a national observatory of sorts. And theirs, like ours, was started for a practical reason, to reform the calendar inherited from Julius Caesar into the Gregorian calendar we all use today. But the work of the Vatican Observatory also continues today, and some of it happens closer to home.
Well, let's remember that the Vatican Observatory is one institution in two locations.
At Castel Gandolfo, right outside of Rome, and right here in our state, on top of Mount Graham in the middle of the desert in southern Arizona, where light pollution doesn't hinder the quality of their observations of the heavens. Its Arizona location dates back to 1980, when the Vatican partnered with the University of Arizona to study the stars under our famously clear skies. Father Corbelli has been there almost since the beginning, for more than 40 years. And he told me, while most people think of priests and think of someone engulfed in robes, saying mass or baptizing babies, he's a priest and an astronomer.
So I do wear robes, celebrate mass, and, you know, baptize babies. So that's all part of it, because I'm a priest in the Jesuit order. But as you say, I'm also a scientist. When I finished my doctorate, which was in astronomy, the then director, Father George Coyne, said, "Now, Chris, where would you like to be based? Mm-hmm. Castel Gandolfo or in Tucson?" It was a no-brainer. Tucson, of course. And in my first year, so springtime of my first year, the University of Arizona made its first new generation telescope mirror. So the mirror is the heart of telescopes, which catch the light from the heavens and then sort of reflect it up and etc. Mm-hmm. So that mirror was offered to the Vatican Observatory to make into a telescope. It still goes by its project name, which is Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope. And so a very exciting project. I knew little about engineering. And I joined the team to make the telescope. Very exciting.
Yeah. So you've been there for 40 years, right? Tell us a little bit about what you study. Like, what do you look at when you look through that telescope?
So when I look through that, or was doing on Kitt Peak, I look at the rainbows or spectra of stars. So you can obviously see them directly and see their light. But just as the sun has a rainbow, so each star has a rainbow as well. And if you look at it in detail, it's not so much the colors that you see, but the lack of them, where the outer atmosphere of the sun is cooler than the center, and that absorbs light that is coming from the interior of the star. And how much is absorbed and which elements are doing the absorbing tells you about, I'd say, the personality of the star.
So you have to explain what that means. Like, what do you mean when you say a personality of a star? Give us an example of one that interests you.
Well, its surface temperature, how well packed it is, so what we call the surface gravity. So what's the gravity on the surface of a star? So that's really saying how big the thing is. And then its composition. Does it have the same kind of abundance of elements as our sun does? That's kind of the personality. And, stars, most of them will fit quite happily, 90% maybe more, fit nicely into slots.
But then there will be ones that don't fit.
Then there'll be ones that don't fit. So there, we call them peculiar stars. Now, we call people peculiar, but all fascinating as are peculiar stars.
What do you love about it?
Well, I find spectra beautiful. You know, I don't see them in color. I see them in, as it were, black and white initially when I was using photographic plates to take the spectra of stars. But now it's digital on the screen, so it's wiggles up and down in intensity and in, as it were, color or wavelength is the other dimension. And they're fascinating.
So I want to talk about the other kind of overarching question that probably looms over a lot of the work that you do and a lot of the questions people have about it, right? Like, just as most people wouldn't assume that a priest is also an astronomer, I'm guessing most people would assume that religion and science conflict, right? Like that religion even denies science most of the time, or the other way around. Do you see that?
I suppose the short answer is no, of course not. Our understanding that we gain of our universe through science is very much part of the overall truth. And if you like, you know, God is the truth with a capital T. And we have lots of truths with smaller t's in all kind of branches that kind of bring together and are part of that overall whole big truth.
Are there times, though, when these things butt up against each other for you? Like when you cannot explain a religious belief with science, like a miracle, or, you know, people know Jesus was supposed to have walked on water, right? Like, how do you kind of answer those questions?
By saying they're beyond science. Precisely, a miracle is something that science cannot explain. A healing is often the thing that's a miracle that's needed before the Catholic Church will declare someone a saint. So a healing that cannot be explained by the doctors is a miracle. Hmm. And these seem to happen, you know, and you can't explain it. The known medicine won't explain it.
Are there examples like that in the astronomy world, things that you cannot explain and you might attribute to the divine?
I don't think so. I think there's a scientific explanation. And people may or may not believe that explanation, but, you know, there is one. Part of the problem in the Bible was when the passage was saying, well, the sun went backwards well, you can't explain that. Did it? What actually was experienced at the time? And that's something we don't know.
It's interesting to me that you keep saying, you know, we just don't know, or this is something we cannot explain. Because to the outsider, at least, to someone who's not a scientist, right? Like, that's the whole point of science, is to be able to explain those things, to create the hypotheses and test it and say, this is the answer. It sounds like as a priest and a scientist, right? Like, you are willing to allow that to be unanswerable sometimes.
Yeah. Well, the same is true in science. Mm. You know, it was put to me by good scientists under whom I studied that in science, you're always asking questions, and what you're doing is asking better questions. So we're asking the same kind of questions that people from, you know, decades, centuries, whatever ago, but we're asking better questions now.
Let me ask you lastly, I wonder this because of the work that you describe that you do and the beauty of it and the beauty that you see in it. Are there moments that you have when you're looking at those spectra, when you feel that connection between the cosmos and the divine that you talked about?
Same as anyone. Away from cities, when the moon is not bright in the sky and it's, so it's really dark sky, the wonder gets even to an astronomer. Just the beauty of the heavens. Now, again, astronomer has better questions about those stars to ask and more thing to wonder, you know, on the distances and the times involved and the energies involved in it all. But it's the same wonder there. You know, when I'm looking at spectra, I'm kind of finding out what God knows about this particular star. Now, God knows in a different way than we do. I might call it, you know, classify it as such and such, or this is a star like our sun, and God's knowledge is different from ours. But it's God's star, and I'm enjoying finding out about it analogously to, as it said, you know, same and different, as God knows and understands this star.
We'll leave it there. That is Father Chris Corbelli with the Vatican Observatory in Tucson joining us. Father Corbelli, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Most welcome. I'm delighted to talk with you.
Last fall, the scientific community went into a minor frenzy. A hunk of interstellar material had been sucked into Earth's gravitational field and was now orbiting the planet. What was it? Teddy Coretta was determined to find out. Coretta is a postdoctoral associate at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, and as he recently told the show's Sam Dingman, studying this mysterious object was a rare and, in his opinion, precious opportunity.
Objects that get this close to the Earth are really, really rare. And it's not so often that these things stick around for not just days or weeks, but months. It was sort of an interesting and exciting time.
And how big was this asteroid?
30 to 40 feet across. So not so big that if it were to impact the Earth, we'd be, you know, thinking about Armageddon or Deep Impact or any of those movies from the 90s, right? But big enough that, you know, we found it well before it got close to the Earth, and we were able to track it for quite a while afterwards.
And when you started tracking it, was there anything unique or remarkable about it?
Right. So I mentioned earlier that it's kind of hard for asteroids to get into orbits this similar to the Earth, right? So we had to think about what other scenarios might put rocks this close by. One of them is that we could have found space junk. So think like the Apollo missions from the 50s. We left a lot of rocket parts up in space. That was one scenario we were worried about, or at least wanted to look into. And the other one, which I think we'd been excited about for a long time, but we'd been looking without success, was looking to see whether or not it could be ejected from the moon. So we got observations of this particular space rock, 2024 PT5, with telescopes both here in Arizona, up near Flagstaff, as well as in Hawaii, to try to figure out what this thing is made out of. And we quickly realized this doesn't look like paint. It doesn't look like metal. It's not lost space junk. And as we looked at the data in a little bit more detail, we started realizing that it didn't really look like any of the known asteroids either. Mm-hmm. So this mini moon, we started to think was a picture, you know, a piece of the real moon.
Well, this is something that you have a particular interest in, right? Is smaller bodies of the solar system, which would include things like hunks of moon, asteroids, comets. What's interesting to you about studying these particular space phenomena?
You know, I think when people think about, you know, astronomers studying the solar system, they think about Jupiter, they think about Pluto, they think about stuff that is pretty big in the grand scheme of things, right? But the vast majority of objects in the solar system are what we call the small bodies, the comets, the asteroids. There are always going to be more of those objects to study with telescopes, with computer models, with laboratory work than will ever get visited by spacecraft, right? As a result, if there are 1.5 million known asteroids, and we've seen maybe 5 to 10 with spacecraft, that's millions of objects left on the table that might have really interesting stories to tell.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, for all the asteroids that get lucky enough to get visited by spacecraft, for all the comets lucky enough to get visited by spacecraft, you're still going to need to compare them to the hundreds or thousands of bodies you've studied with telescopes and in other ways, just because that's the only context you have, right?
So if I'm hearing you right, there's kind of two factors here. One is the possibility of discovering something on a small body like this that has an interesting story to tell, but also just building out the base of knowledge for comparison for studies of other bodies that will eventually be looked at. Can you give me an example of either with this particular mini moon or another small body that you've studied of one of those interesting stories that surprised you?
Sure. Back in 2019, the second interstellar object was discovered. Interstellar object is the sort of category, the name of the category for comets and asteroids that were formed around other stars. You know, you might have heard of exoplanets, planets around other stars. These are the small bodies of those solar systems. They get thrown out every once in a while. And so far, we've found two. As they pass through our own solar system on their way for somewhere else, you get a few months to study them, and it's over forever. In a lot of ways, it's kind of the study of small bodies in the solar system on hard mode. because we hadn't found any of these objects yet, we didn't know what the interesting questions were to ask yet, right? We hope that given this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to study this object before it went away, we hope we measured the stuff that matters, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think it took maybe 3 weeks before another paper came out that more or less showed that conclusively we had no idea what we were measuring. And I think there are people who would find that kind of frustrating. But we learned a lot more about how in the future, we know the better questions to ask next time. We're going to do better.
Yeah.
It feels iterative, but in a sort of hopeful and encouraging way.
Yeah. I do find that idea just personally very compelling, that the goal here is not ultimate answers, because we're never going to get the ultimate answers. It's fewer questions tomorrow or smarter questions tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. You know, compared to 30 years ago, where it was a handful of groups in a handful of countries hunting for potentially dangerous space rocks, comets, these sorts of things, it's now a real international effort with tons and tons of people involved, really smart people working really long hours to try to keep the Earth as safe as possible, right? There's still going to be, you know, rocks worth worrying about, comets worth worrying about. But it's a really tremendous large group of smart people working, you know, day and very much night to keep everyone safe, right? You know, that should make you feel good.
Yeah. Have you ever seen anything in your research that gave you even a flicker of a scare about some kind of deep impact or Armageddon scenario? Or is the possibility of that so remote that it's not even worth thinking about?
I think the scientists who work this problem regularly have kind of just learned to accept that, yeah, at any given time, there's a few things worth keeping an eye on. But on a day-to-day basis, I'm not struggling to fall asleep or anything.
Yeah.
One thing that was really exciting in sort of this area is a couple of years ago, I was really involved in the DART spacecraft, the double asteroid redirection test. We were exactly trying to test what they do in the movies, right? Can you push an asteroid away onto a trajectory where it doesn't hit the Earth? And within a couple of minutes of us hitting the moon of this one asteroid, we already had an idea that, okay, this technique really works. In a pinch, this is something that's in our toolkit.
You know?
You know, I'd rather that we never have to deflect an asteroid. I'd rather we didn't have to worry about it at all. But I'd also like to know if the techniques we have that could be tried work. Right. And, you know, I don't want to be in the last minute, you know, giving the president the big button where you could like joystick the missile towards the asteroid. Right. I'd rather we just knew exactly what to do in what order. And that means you got to test this stuff ahead of time.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
You know, I think even the scientists who worry about this on a day-to-day basis, knowing that something like DART would work, knowing that we're getting better at hunting for these potentially dangerous objects out in space, both of those are really good news for everybody.
Well, I've been speaking with Dr. Teddy Carretta, a postdoctoral associate at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. Dr. Carretta, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sam. Pleasure to talk to you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. In honor of Valentine's Day, this week we're taking a look at different kinds of love. Up first, writer Trajan Dunkley on a teenage crush.
A pint of chocolate ice cream sits on my counter and I grab a fork. I'm a couple of bites in before I realize I've left little irrigation tracks in the green cream, licked the tines clean. After all this time, she's still with me. There is a girl whose name is not Ariel, but she came out of the sea and bewitched me, so it's as good a name as any. Everyone is in love with her, the way you will love the new girl you have not known since they were a scabby, neat third grader. I am 16 and so sophisticated that I have invented love just to bestow on Ariel. I create ruses to stay close to her, and somehow it works. We are best friends, watching the sunset on her roof. I am deathly afraid of falling off the precarious ladder leading to the roof, but I want to show her I am brave and worthy of her love. My heart pounds with fear, with desire, as I make it rung by rung to her, sitting cross-legged, holding a pint of ice cream and two forks. "It tastes better on a fork, I think," she says. Now I think so too. There is a boy who is named like a Disney prince, and I hate him. He doesn't bully me, but his friends do, and he has no problem standing back and watching. He drives a car as loud as his mouth, and worst of all, she's in love with him. I can't understand how an angel could love someone so pedestrian. I hate that by virtue of his sex, he can obtain what should be mine by right. He tolerates me, like a girlfriend's ill-tempered cat. He says hello in the hallways, and I ignore him. Now he intervenes when his friends are too cruel to me, but I feel no gratitude. It's all a trick to make her think he's some shining prince. But I, in my infinite wisdom, know what he is, my rival. Somehow, he keeps tricking her. Year after year after year, they stay together and talk of marriage and babies and all other matters not fitting for my muse. I have to save her from the drudgery of marrying such a toad. If I finally tell her how deeply I've loved her all these years, she'll see that she could love someone who would write verses to the gold in her hair, who understands her gentle, poetic soul. I tell her, "You're Ariel," the name that is not her name, the subject of my verses haphazardly collected on a poorly designed Tumblr blog that, of course, she's followed for years. It is all for her, and now she knows it. She smiles and takes my hand and says, "Oh, I had a feeling. And thank you. You always wrote such lovely things about me." There is so much left unsaid, but tacitly understood. She is in love with her Disney prince. Even if she wasn't, it would be another boy, never a woman, who would win her heart. We can go back to life as it was if we never bring up this truth again. And so we don't. We still share our poetry and climb on her roof and eat our ice cream with forks. And as time goes on, the intensity of first infatuation fades and the steady calm of a dear friendship remains. But she still stays with me whenever I stick a fork in my ice cream.
That was Phoenix writer Trajan Dunkley, who is now in love with her own prince. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.